So our speaker today is Will Barker from the University of Cambridge. So Will is currently a graduate student who's finishing up his PhD. He's been especially interested, you know, during his PhD in topics related to modified gravity theories. and so today he'll be telling us about some of his recent work on torsion cosmology and beyond. And so Will, take it away whenever you're ready.
All right, thank you so much, Neil. And thank you for inviting me to give a seminar. So today I'm gonna talk about the role of torsion in cosmology from hopefully a bit of a more general perspective than you might be used to. So I'll give a very quick crash course in what torsion is. We're used to general relativity, where we have our gravitational field described by a metric tensor. And you can have an affine connection, which is your Levi-Civita connection, which is completely determined by the metric tensor. There's another formulation of gravity where you split the metric tensor into a pair of tetrads. So it's basically like the tetrad is the square root of the metric in some sense. And you can also leave the affine connection free to vary on its own without the input of the tetrad by introducing this quantity A, which is a spin connection. So if that's true, then your affine connection is no longer just going to be a Levi-Civita connection. It's going to have some other quantity dangling on the end, which you call the contortion tensor. So going back to general relativity again, or a metric-based theory, you have really one main field strength tensor that you can deal with, which is your Riemann curvature tensor. And that's just defined in terms of the affine connection as usual. But if you're dealing with tetrads and spin connections, then you can have two different field strength tensors. So you've got a Riemann-Cartan tensor, and you've got a torsion tensor. And so there's a fundamental structural difference between these new field strength tensors and the Riemann curvature, which is that these new tensors, they're linear in the gravitational potentials, spin connection and tetrad derivatives. Whereas the Riemann curvature tensor, of course, it contains second derivatives of the metric. So why would we do any of this? Well, the formalism is really in some sense necessary if you want to couple spinners to gravity, right? So if you want to have fermions in your theory, then you need to refer to a local Lorentz basis. So that inspires the use of the tetrads. That local Lorentz basis is free to move around. It can move under Lorentz rotations, which gives you another gauge freedom in the theory. So not only are you gauging the diffeomorphisms of coordinate transformations as in a metric-based theory, but you're also combining that with Lorentz rotations. So your new gauge group is going to be the Poincaré group. So you've expanded your gauge group, and the gauge theme plays quite heavily throughout all of this, because the field strength tensors, as I said before, they look like first derivatives of the gravitational fields plus some quadratic term in those fields. So this is a very Yang-Mills kind of formalism for your gravitational field strengths. And you don't really get that quite so cleanly in general relativity. As I said, you've got these second derivatives of the metric, and you can't really recover the structure constants so cleanly. So this overall formalism is really quite old. It's getting on for 70 years old now. So I just put some of the earliest and most famous references down there. But that's basically where this idea of torsion comes from. But we don't really have a gravitational theory yet. So if you're dealing with a metric, we all know what the favorite gravitational theory is. We have our field strength tensor, the Riemann curvature tensor, and we just get the linear invariant of that. And that's our Einstein-Hilbert action. And then we have GR. If we want to build a theory out of Riemann-Cartan curvature and torsion, then there are two favorites, I think you could probably say, which are the Einstein-Cartan theory and the teleparallel theory. So this is the Einstein-Cartan theory. It's the exact analog of the favorite general relativity, in that you're just using the linear invariance of the Riemann-Cartan curvature. the teleparallel theory. It's built using these quadratic torsion invariants. Both of these theories are interesting because they are dynamically equivalent to general relativity with some caveats. Even though, you know, the teleparallel theory looks really quite strange, you've got this quadratic Lagrangian. So sticking to the theme of a quadratic Lagrangian, what I'm going to talk about in this, this seminar is a more general case where we include all of the quadratic invariants that we can think of. We keep the linear invariants. We include these six quadratic Riemann-Cartan curvature invariants, and we have the three quadratic torsion invariants as well. So in total, this theory has 10 dimensionless coupling constants. The reason I don't go beyond quadratic invariants is because we want to keep things stable. And it's worth mentioning that you can eliminate one of the quadratic Riemann-Cartan terms with a topological identity as well. But I'll leave that in throughout the whole of this talk. Yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
I think I would have imagined that Ostrogradsky's theorem would limit the quadratic terms too to only the Gauss-Bonnet term. Is that not right?
Only the Gauss-Bonnet term.
Well, I just normally don't the quadratic and curvature terms lead to extra?
Yes. If you're using the Riemann curvature, yes, because you're going to have then a higher order theory, right? You're going to have fourth powers of derivatives.
But you're saying in this.
If you go back to just at the bottom here, you can see that the new field strengths are first order in the derivatives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this should be fine with Ostrogradsky now. We can include quadratic terms effectively with impunity. There may still be instabilities, but it won't suffer from the same problems.
Okay.
Okay, so we now want to sort of confine this a little bit because we have these 10 dimensionless coupling constants. That's horrible. We want to narrow it down.
Let me just check again. So then by that same argument, what precludes one from using cubic curvature terms then if one's in the first order formalism?
Terms, I'd rather not have a third power of a derivative.
Uh-huh.
That seems to court disaster.
Uh-huh. So it's not that it has second derivative.
Yeah, this might not be strictly Ostrogradsky at this point. Uh-huh. I think there are probably other problems if you have a cubic derivative in the Lagrangian. Be that as it may, I'm sticking with second powers just for the moment.
Sounds good.
So a popular requirement for a gravitational theory is that it would contain Minkowski space as a vacuum. So one way you can look at this is you can linearize your theory on a Minkowski background, and you can say, okay, let's take away all of the matter, let's take away any cosmological constant, and just see does the theory stay stable on that background. So this is work that was done by some colleagues of mine. They looked at the 10 parameter theory and they found all of the different cases, and there are nearly 2000 cases which have to be individually considered, where the dimensionless coupling constants obey some relations whereby the Lagrangian becomes singular. And so you have to eliminate some degrees of freedom in order to invert it and look at the propagator. So the theory breaks down into these 2000 different cases which have to be treated separately if you linearize it on the Minkowski background. And they found that there are 450 of those cases where you can impose extra constraints on the dimensionless coupling constants so that you can get it to be unitary. And then an extra 58 special cases of those 450, whereby the theory lends itself to power counting renormalizability. Now that last criterion is...
May I ask?
Yes.
So about these cases, so when you say critical cases or this, yes, 450 which are viable, does it mean kind of are these regions in parameter space, or yes, there must be really, yes, like some tunings between the parameters? Yes.
They're regions and not finely tuned cases. So you're just
not finely tuned.
You're breaking the 10 dimensional space into sections.
I see. So it's not that there should be some algebraic relations between the parameters. It's really like inequality.
Well, there is. Well, no, there is an algebraic relation, but I wouldn't say it was finely tuned. So these relations look like, you know, some linear combination of the parameters is equal to zero.
That's tuning. That means that.
Okay.
Relation. Okay. So it's like subspaces, lower dimensions.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'll come back to whether or not power quantum renormalizability is actually desirable a little bit later on in the talk. But
I think that's also relates to this point that if there are particular relations, one should ensure that they are stable under renormalization. Okay.
I guess there's a question of whether the relations are imposed by a symmetry or not.
Right. Yeah. If they were imposed by symmetry, that would be great. Yeah.
Is that the bullet point seems to suggest that?
Yes. The relations are motivated by the fact that if you impose these relations amongst the coupling constants, you'll get an emergent gauge symmetry. So your Lagrange, the rank of the Lagrangian operator basically changes, and so you have to do a bit more work before you can get the propagator out. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that sounds okay. You will talk about that more in your talk, right?
A little bit later. Yes. Yeah. And we can definitely come back to it at the end.
Okay. Thank you.
So we take this catalog of cases, and you can see here. This is what you were talking about. That these are the relations amongst the dimensionless coupling constants that define the particular cases. In the second column, we've got the inequalities that guarantee unitarity in the linearized theory. And then in the final columns, these are estimates of the particle spectrum that come out from examining the structure of the propagator. So the main point I'm trying to make here is that these requirements of unitarity and power quantum renormalizability, they were shown to eliminate the possibility of having the Ricci scalar in the Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian is required to be a only quadratic curvature plus quadratic torsion terms. So the particle content overall, it sometimes looks quite promising. So you'll get these two massless degrees of freedom, which can be identified with a graviton. And the only other particle that you can get out propagating is a massive pseudoscalar particle. So what we've done
So I don't think I understand why this power counting like criterion eliminates Einstein-Hilbert, because power counting I would imagine it refers to high energy limits, so which is dominated by higher derivatives, but I mean by terms which have more derivatives, okay, which are your quadratic terms. And then the Einstein-Hilbert is just not relevant at high energies. So how?
So I agree. You'll have a first derivative only sitting there from the Einstein-Hilbert in this case. So I'm not sure. It could be that it has also to do with the stability, because this is a combination of power quantum renormalizability and also requiring unitarity. It could also be just a complete accident. So I don't know if there's a general reason why this is true.
Sorry, I don't see the connection here. So here, so how is that table implying that power counting aborts Einstein-Hilbert?
There was an exhaustive catalog made of all of the different cases where new symmetries arise. Then you determine whether or not it's possible to have these theories be unitary. And then you ask that the powers of K that appear in the propagator lend themselves to the PCR criterion. So once all of that is done, you end up with a list. None of these theories allow you to, that they all switch off the alpha naught parameter.
Okay. I think I see. I guess the statement is that that's I mean, it's a non-normalizable term. So basically, I mean, Planck mass is dimensionful. So in some sense, if you want to have only dimensionless coupling constants, then you don't want to have Einstein-Hilbert.
Yes, it could be that. So you'll end up with, you won't be able to form a conformal theory if you have just Einstein-Hilbert there.
This would not spoil the invisibility because it would be just like relevant deformation at low energies. And,
yeah, no, that's
like a mass cannot spoil the invisibility.
Sure, no, that's true. No, I guess it would be irrelevant for the UV. I think I agree with what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Thanks. So, what we did was we threw the idea of a background cosmology. These theories in general. So we put in an ansatz for the Petrad to be FRW, and we leave the spatial curvature completely general. And the cosmological ansatz for the torsion restricts the torsion to have two scalar degrees of freedom. So there's a scalar term U and a pseudo-scalar Q that sits in the torsion tensor. And if you do that, then you also find that amongst the 10 coupling constants, you'll end up with only certain combinations of those constants actually ever appearing in the cosmological equations of motion, which you would probably expect. So those are the sigmas and epsilons, and there are five of those. and then if you look at the mini superspace equations, then the thing that should be noticed is that if you firstly remove the Einstein-Hilbert term and remove a specific combination of quadratic curvature terms, then the spatial curvature actually drops out of the equations of motion. So your universe could, according to this, be flat, open, or closed, but this would not affect the evolution of the Hubble number or the torsion. So I'll leave that aside just for a moment, and we'll come back to that. What we did was we then took this catalog of theories, and we then mapped this onto the implications for cosmology. So we're basically grouping these theories by whether or not they switch off some of these cosmological coupling constants, these key combinations. I'll just skip over these few slides here. So the main point is that hopefully you guys can see my mouse. On the left-hand side of the diagram, you get this cube-shaped group of theories, which have not been considered before in the literature. And they have this K-screening property. So Einstein-Hilbert goes away, and the sigma 3, which is this group, this combination of quadratic curvature terms, this goes away as well. And so in principle, these should have the K-screened cosmology, whatever that means. So we will pick a theory which is not so constrained that it's going to be too boring, and not so unconstrained that it's going to be difficult to work with. And we see, well, what does the cosmology actually look like? I'll skip over some of the details, but effectively what we find is that the theory is capable of reproducing the flat Friedman solutions of general relativity, which is quite strange. So despite the fact that the equations of motion can't see the spatial curvature, what you end up with is the sum of the densities in the matter sector is equal to one. So it's just the Friedman equation again. So this plot here just shows co-moving Hubble with respect to scale factor. And this is an extra parameter that in the theory that we do have to tune. We have to set the ratio of two couplings to one in order to get exact agreement with GR. But numerically, I would say that's quite natural. That's fine. Bizarrely, we have, even without the Einstein-Hilbert term and even without the theory being sensitive to the spatial curvature, we have somehow recovered a Friedman-like solution. We can perturb that solution. If we perturb that solution, what it looks like is the cosmology of general relativity plus an extra matter component, where the equation of state parameter of the extra matter depends on the equation of state parameter of the dominant physical matter in the universe. And I give that in this equation here. The main takeaway is that if radiation is dominant in the universe, then a perturbation to this background solution will look like extra radiation or less radiation. If matter is present in the universe, is dominant, then you'll get an extra component if you perturb the solution that looks like warm dark matter. That's warm dark matter. And then if dark energy is dominant, then you get this negative pressure effective component. So these two components will redshift away quite quickly at late times. And really the main effect is that you get this tunable dark radiation component. Allows us to,
Where does this extra parameter of yours go, iota that you defined in the previous slide?
Say again, sorry, which parameter?
This extra parameter that you had defined for
the previous slide.
Yeah.
Was it this one?
Yeah. I don't know what you call this. Zeta or?
I say sigma. Essentially, sigma one and sigma two are free in the theory that comes from unitarity PCR and all of that. And then at the level of the phenomenology, I would just set this ratio to one, and you observe that exact Friedmann solution comes out of this. So
in the next slide, what do you choose for this parameter?
One.
Pick one exact.
Yes. Okay. So the main point is that you get to increase or decrease the early expansion rate. Mm-hmm. And I just show this here relative to lambda CDM. So this is the controversial slide. We were very excited when we found this because, of course, we have the Hubble tension problem. One of the earliest proposed solutions to this was to change the number of relativistic degrees of freedom in the universe. To a certain extent, this does alleviate the tension, but it collides very heavily with known bounds on the thermal history. So this probably won't work, but it may in some sense contribute at the end of the day, and once perturbations are factored in, if they ever are. I'll next take a step back to the 10 parameter theory and talk about the general consequences of torsion in the cosmology. Remember, we have this big parameter theory, but the torsion is only adding these two scalars, U and Q. These aren't really scalar fields in the sense that we would like to work with scalar fields in a Lagrangian field theory. So they don't have a definite conformal weight yet. At least U doesn't. And the reason for that is that torsion doesn't transform homogeneously under scale transformations. So you can motivate a pair of properly defined scalar fields, phi and psi, by the U and Q scalars if you factor in the Hubble number. So then phi and psi will have conformal weights of -1, and these will be well-posed scalar fields with which you can work. So what do we want to do with this? Well, the idea we have is to say, okay, you have a horrible quadratic torsion theory. You look at the Lagrangian, you have really no idea what the phenomenology is going to be. It's just a complete mess. But if you write down a scalar tensor theory, you can often just by looking at the Lagrangian figure out, well, what is this going to do? Right? It's the anatomy of the theory is normally quite transparent if it's a scalar tensor theory. So the idea is to take the quadratic torsion theory and write down a scalar tensor theory of gravity without any torsion, just built with the metric and two scalar fields, which reproduces the background cosmology of the quadratic torsion theory. So the only way really to do this is to build an ansatz for the scalar tensor theory and then match the equations of motion. We did initially try extension of the Hondesky Lagrangian for the ansatz. So this is the Bi-Galileian theory, which is a fairly general theory. It's not quite good enough, it turns out, because these arbitrary G functions, you would want them to be polynomials. Turns out that they cannot be polynomials. So if you build a Bi-Galileian theory and then try to reproduce the effects of torsion, it doesn't really work. It can be done with the aid of a couple of multiplier fields. So we introduce this vector B and another scalar chi, and then build a new ansatz. It looks kind of ugly, but it's also quite similar to these Lorentz violating vector fields that you sometimes read about. And we can get rid of these multipliers. You can write down an equivalent Lagrangian, but you do so at the expense of the G functions being polynomials. And so the final scalar tensor theory that you get out is this big non-canonical theory. This square root term here is the price we pay for getting rid of the multiplier fields. So this here is the scalar tensor theory without any torsion that reproduces the background cosmology of quadratic torsion theories. So it's quite complicated. I'll just go through the anatomy of it. First thing to notice is that it wants to be interpreted in the Jordan frame. So in some sense, the Jordan frame of the scalar tensor theory is the physical frame. It's the one we actually started with when we made the correspondence. And you can see that you've got this nominal coupling for the scalars in front of the Ricci scalar here. Remember, this Ricci scalar has no torsion in it. This is just a Riemann curvature. And in fact, this Ricci scalar is the only appearance of gravity in the theory. So we started with a quadratic torsion curvature theory, and it's reproduced, its background cosmology is reproduced by a theory which only has Ricci scalar in it. So we've gone from a quadratic theory to a linear theory, which is also quite strange. Another thing to notice is that the factors in front of the kinetic terms and in front of the non-minimal coupling terms, these differ by 12. So the theory will lend itself to conformally coupled scalars, which is quite nice. And of course, the really horrible part is this non-canonical kinetic structure, which appears down here. So I've just written the square root of this J current squared, and the J current is basically the derivatives of the scalar fields. Beyond that, we have some mass terms, which is fine. We can use those to make some claims about tachyons. And then we have some quartic potentials, which may come in useful if we want to do some inflation. Perhaps the weirdest thing about this is that if you remember, alpha naught went in front of the Ricci scalar in the torsion theory. It doesn't go in front of the Ricci scalar in the scalar tensor theory. So let's drill down into that a little bit more. If we start with the torsion theory that just has the Ricci scalar in it. So this is going to be the Einstein-Cartan theory. And then we ask, what's the scalar tensor analog of that theory for the background cosmology? We just get out this bizarre looking non-canonical scalar theory without reference to gravity at all. There's no Ricci scalar in this. So you think this is ludicrous. It's not going to reproduce the background cosmology. It turns out it does. This thing is it's called the quadratic cuscuton. The psi field goes away. It's non-dynamical. This square root of kinetic term of phi and phi squared. If you evaluate the cosmological equations of motion of that theory, you do get out the Friedmann equations again. If you take the phi equation of motion and then you substitute it into the g mu nu equation, it basically gives you the Friedmann equations back, which is quite bizarre. So it does work. It just has a very weird perspective on the Einstein-Cartan theory. We can also try the Teller parallel theory. So this particular combination of torsion terms.
Can you go back? I'm confused. So you say you start with this Einstein-Hilbert, or I guess Einstein-Cartan term in the this is the first order formalism. So that R has torsion in it at the top.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, okay. Yes.
And then you do this, you try to come up with a scalar tensor theory that reproduces the same cosmology. Yes. And then you end up with just this cuscuton and then no Einstein-Hilbert term?
No Einstein-Hilbert.
Okay.
But this is only the cosmological background. So for perturbations, this is going to get...
Okay, cool.
So we can do this for teleparallel as well. It should give us the same result because, you know, teleparallel is dynamically equivalent to GR. If you perform the mapping with the parameters, you do actually get the Riemann Einstein-Hilbert term in this case, but you also got a cuscuton sort of dangling on the end. That's not the full story because in the teleparallel theory, you have to artificially remove the curvature. You do that normally through some multiplier terms. When you artificially remove the Riemann-Cartan curvature, that has the same effect as artificially switching off the scalar fields. So we just put a line through this term dangling on the end, and we get back the Einstein-Hilbert action without torsion, which is what you would expect. So in some sense, teleparallel theory actually looks more natural in this this bizarre analog than the Einstein-Cartan theory. We can also do this in the other way, from the other way around. Instead of starting with some popular torsion theories and asking what scalar tensor theories do they give us, we can start with a, we can try and construct a torsion theory that will give us a desirable scalar tensor theory. So this, these are some fairly natural looking parameter constraints to impose on the torsion theory, and it will give us something very horrible looking. The term I've highlighted here can actually be simplified quite a lot, because there's a, another fun identity that you can do with the Cuskuton field, which is that this Cuskuton Z is actually weightless, right? So it's a ratio of the two weighted scalar fields. But if you get a weightless quadratic Cuskuton and you conformally couple it to a weighted scalar psi, that has equivalent cosmology to psi conformally coupled to gravity. So these two terms here actually get absorbed into these two terms here, and the whole thing just looks like a conformally coupled scalar field with a mass, which, you know, people have used these for many years if they are trying to build inflationary models and so forth. So these are just examples. If we go back to map of promising theories that that we had earlier. Remember that we identified a theory that was, you know, it's not so constrained, it's not so free either. And we found it had some interesting background cosmology to it. What we really want to do next is we want to say, okay, what's the most general new theory that we can play with? What does it imply? What's it actually going to give us? So that's going to be the theory I've called A here. Basically, it's the general quadratic proportion theory. Remove the Einstein-Hilbert. Remove this combination of curvature squared, such that the only thing you've imposed is the K-screening condition. So see what this does. I should point out the particle content of A and C differ slightly. So C, it only had two massless degrees of freedom and power in the spin two part of the propagator. So I would have said that C, it probably contains something like a graviton only. A, by relaxing this parameter constraints, you actually activate the massive pseudoscalar mode as well. So this is gonna have an extra pseudoscalar in that moves. So let's see what the consequences of this are. So the scalar tensor analog is a bit messy. And remember that it wants to be interpreted in the Jordan frame as the physical frame. To do the calculations, we move over to the Einstein frame. It's a bit simpler. And in the Einstein frame, the theory just looks like Riemann. So it's Einstein gravity. And then a canonical scalar field Z. I've defined Z and zeta here just because when you go from Jordan to Einstein frame, you normally end up with a big mess and you have to reparameterize your fields to tidy things up a bit. So you end up with a canonical field Z, which has some potential V. And then you've got quadratic Cuskuton here, which is the zeta field. And it's going to be regulated by this omega of Z function. So omega of Z is some boring function. You don't need to worry about the details of what it is. But it's interesting to notice that omega actually parameterizes the degree to which the Jordan and Einstein frames have deviated from each other. So what I'm trying to show here is that this is just a conformal transformation on the metric to go from Jordan to Einstein frame, and you can write it entirely in terms of the omega function. I actually can't remember now which way around it goes. Yes.
So I'm a bit confused about the logic of what you are doing. So you started from the torsion theory and, okay, impose some conditions, power counter renormalizability, absence of Gauss stability and everything. And found that it's some of these series, I mean, there is a map of this series that you are referring to. But then you are substituting it with a scalar tensor theory, which is not equivalent, as far as I understand, to what you are studying. It only produces the same cosmology. But like in terms of perturbations, it can be completely different. For example, we don't know if it's in any sense power counting are normalizable or if it's stable or not. So what is is the logic of reason, back and forth?
The reason that we've introduced the scalar tensor theory is just that it makes it easier to study the background cosmology of the theory. This is a utility. In terms of stability, I'll talk about that a little bit in the final section, and perhaps perturbations as well. These questions are very much different from studying the cosmological background. They're far more complicated, and they also have the potential to destroy the theories. High-spin theories are notoriously unstable. And so when you seriously consider these, and I'll be doing it using the Hamiltonian analysis later, you end up with some very serious problems emerging. But this, for the moment, is just a utility to look at the cosmological background from the perspective of a scalar tensor theory, whereby you write down the Lagrangian, you can often just see what it's doing. You can see, oh, there's a potential there, there's a kinetic term, et cetera, there might be some gravity braiding, some kinetic braiding, or non-minimal coupling, et cetera. It's just a utility.
I see. So we should not think about perturbations of this.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. Well, there may be some circumstances under which that is safe. Certainly, for the case of the Einstein-Cartan theory being the Cuskyton theory, that cannot be true. I mean, just to look at it, that this is not going to give you anything serious if you try and do the perturbations. So. So don't take this too seriously. It's just a case of the background. Is there going to be inflation? Is there going to be dark energy, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Oh, could I just ask another thing which I wasn't sure of? So in this parameter space of torsion full theories that you're considering, is there some subset that reduces to Newtonian gravity and then in the non-relativistic limit and agrees with GR in the solar system? Is that sort of constraint being imposed anywhere, or is that something that's to be checked later? Or
so that's for my final slide, but I'll say now we do have for these particular theories. If I go back, right, so this pair here, they accommodate the Schwarzschild vacuum, and they also accommodate PP waves. You throw the ansatz of the equations of motion and they happen to work. So as for the stability of the Schwarzschild vacuum, it's not something I've looked at. If you linearize the exact solution, sure, you should be able to get Newtonian gravity out of that. But I'm not really going to go into that too much just for this talk. This talk is really more about cosmology than the various other desirable solutions that we want.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yes. Just that it might. I mean, I bet there's a further important constraints on the
practice that
come from that.
We only have two constraints to define this theory, so this is I'd be very surprised if it miraculously worked.
Mm-hmm.
So just going back to this theory, the other thing to notice is that the potential of the canonical field is positive definite, and that was fixed by some of the unitarity conditions that were found right at the beginning of the talk. And so we know from that that the V term here is going to contribute a bit like a dark energy term in general. So let's try and sort of drill into that a little bit, see how that works. I haven't really gone through much of the algebra here because it is a bit lengthy, but effectively a fun thing to do is to throw in a negative ad hoc cosmological constant to the theory in the same way as you would add a positive cosmological constant to Einstein's theory. So if you add a negative cosmological constant to Einstein's theory, you'll think, well, you're never going to get a de Sitter expansion out of this. But for this general theory, we actually find you do get a de Sitter expansion. Not only that, but the curvature of the de Sitter space is only a function of the Planck mass, so whatever dimensionality you put in the Lagrangian at the beginning, and the free couplings on the field strength invariants. It's not a function of the magnitude of the negative cosmological constant. So that's quite bizarre. I don't know if that has much utility. If you find a theory giving you a negative cosmological constant, this might be a way to reconcile it with observation, but you can confirm that it does happen. So this is just dynamical systems plot. You can see the yellow region is going to be the accelerated expansion, blue is going to be decelerated, and we've thrown into the equations a negative cosmological constant here, and you see that it prefers to accelerate. There's an attractor B. So a more respectable picture is given by if you put in either a zero cosmological constant or a positive cosmological constant. you find that the sitter state you get out looks exactly as you would expect with the bare value of the cosmological constant, but it's been augmented here by this again this contribution from the couplings and the dimensionality you put into your Lagrangian. And all of this sits on top of the previous phenomenology of you can get out lambda CDM and you can get a dark radiation as well. So really what I'm trying to say is that this more general theory inherits everything that I talked about before from this theory, but it also allows you to have dark energy in your theory as well. So the problem here, of course, is that this cannot be the final answer to the cosmological constant problem because there was never a more manifest hierarchy, right? You've literally got a ratio of the two couplings that you would prefer to be of the same order. And so you're going to have 10 to the minus many problem emerging here. But it's something else to consider. It can give a dark energy contribution. So finally, this is where everything goes off a cliff. We ask, okay, how seriously can we take this? Well, when you work on these things, you only gradually start to realize the problems with them. So as time went by, we thought, okay, we have this wonderful phenomenology, just throwing in these classical ansatz. Everything seems to work quite well. We started off by asking that the theory can do a Minkowski background. Whether or not you actually want Minkowski to be a vacuum solution, I don't really know how useful that is, but perhaps to sit it would be better. It depends. And the power counter renormalizability argument as well, do we really want that? Well, it's in some sense, it's better than Einstein. But also perhaps you would be searching instead for like a fixed point in renormalization group flow or some other more exotic route out of the UV problem. So I don't know how useful that is either. The real problem is that we did the unitarity analysis on the linearized theory. And something that's quite a serious problem with high spin theories is that what looks like a very stable theory once it's linearized, if you develop into the nonlinear part through some strong field regime in your vacuum, then you can get an instability developing. And so this could be a serious pathology. The only real way to address this problem is through the nonlinear Hamiltonian analysis, as far as I know. So I'll just jump into how am I doing for time, Neil?
Maybe like another 15 minutes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. In GR, you have your metric, which has 10 degrees of freedom when you first look at it. Then you're going to take away 8 for gauge reasons. Similarly, in the torsion theory, you've got your tetras and spin connection. It will give you 40 degrees of freedom. But you've now got the Poincaré gauge symmetry as well. That's got 10 generators to it. So you're going to end up only with 20 degrees of freedom in the best case scenario, and possibly some of those will be constrained. So those 20 degrees of freedom, actually, it's quite instructive to break those down. The 20 contain the two polarizations of the graviton, and then the remaining 18 are distributed amongst the multiplicities of a scalar, vector, and tensor modes, which are typically massive. Pardon me. If you want to actually do the Hamiltonian analysis, essentially you find that the Pym-like parts of the tetrad and the spin connection are non-propagating from the beginning. So you end up with 30 degrees of freedom in the remaining fields. And then you can break those down into these further IREPs. And I've called these phi functions. So that the precise motivation for defining these phi functions is a bit involved, but basically you can define these functions which take the form, and this is the important part, they take the form of canonical momenta plus field parts. If you define your canonical momenta in the usual way, you find, okay, this is going to be derivative of Lagrangian with respect to the velocity of your fields. These definitions can imply that some of these phi functions are going to equal zero. And this is true even before you started to consider the dynamics. So these are the primary constraints in the theory. And whether or not this happens for any particular phi, it depends on which dimensionless couplings you put in the 10 parameter theory. And the way we, this is mostly a sort of textbook introduction to Hamiltonian analysis, but the way we impose the primary constraints is we just enforce them with a multiplier fields, which I call U. So this is a very schematic notation. There are 10 phi functions in general. And then not only do we need the phi functions to vanish as enforced by the propagators, we also need them to have zero velocity when you actually propagate as enforced by the multipliers. We also need them to have zero velocity when you propagate the theory through space. So that zero velocity requirement eventually gives you that this integrand here should vanish. And the implications of this integrand vanishing depend on whether or not the commutators of the phis with each other actually vanish. So if they don't vanish, then you can solve for a multiplier. If they do vanish, then this first term here also has to become a constraint. So those are the secondary constraints, and the process continues, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the Dirac-Bergmann algorithm. And then once that process is finished, you can then sort of subtract however many degrees of freedom you've constrained from your original 20, and you know what is moving and what is not in your theory. Okay. So the point I would like to make is that this matrix here between, and this isn't zero, it looks like it's going to be zero, but let's say phi I, phi j, something like that. The matrix of commutators between all the possible primaries, it has a big impact on what happens as you evaluate the constraint chain. So you can think of it a bit like that's the initial data on the process of evaluating the constraint structure of the theory. So if you change this as you go, if you change the structure of this matrix as you go from the linearized theory on some ideal desirable vacuum to the nonlinear theory, then it's quite likely that you're going to end up with extra particles being activated. That could be a problem because those particles could be ghostly and you can develop instabilities. So the requirement we have is that the structure of this matrix or its rank should not change as you go from the linear to the nonlinear theory. There is a more controversial requirement which exists in the literature, which is that not only should that be true, but the rank of the matrix in general should not change as you change the values of the fields. And the reason this, I've given the references here, the reasoning behind this is because this can be associated with acausal behavior. So people are more comfortable, I think, these days with acausal modes, you know, particularly in things like biometric gravity and so forth. So, you know, take it or leave it, but I'm going to stick with the fact that the primary Poisson matrix should not change its structure as you go from linear to nonlinear and not the more stringent requirement. So here are the primary Poisson matrices of eight of the theories that we had in that big table at the beginning. These are the only ones I've done so far. Ignore the dotted lines and the crosses in the middle. These lay out whether or not the particles are going to be massive or not, and that does have an impact because when you get a vanishing mass, you get an emergent gauge symmetry, and that also has an effect. But the point is that when you go from the linearized theory, all of these matrices are empty, so a dot means zero. And these are the phi functions, these are the primary constraints. So every dot here is a commutator between the primaries on the shell defined by the primary constraints. When you go to the nonlinear theory, hopefully the screen resolution is high enough, you can see that you get a lot of garbage appearing, which is really worrying, right? So this is the classical story of a very promising theory of gravity, which drives itself on a cliff because you off a cliff because you have all of these changes in the constraint structure that will follow from this.
And the nonlinear, yes. Sorry, the nonlinear theory you're talking about is the quadratic and curvature and torsion theory, the sort of eight yes. parameter theory. That yeah, okay, thanks.
Yes, yeah. So two of these theories they actually do they do seem to work at this level. It turns out if you chase the constraint chain a bit further, that they also fall down. Okay, so. We should also check that this is actually a problem because it could be that, you know, we go off Minkowski space and we find another mode moves, but it's also a well-behaved mode. That would be a bit bizarre. I don't really know how to imagine that, but this doesn't necessarily follow that these are unstable. So you can check the stability really quite easily. So this is the canonical Hamiltonian and you can extract from that the kinetic part, this H per. So n and alpha, these are Laplacian shift. And then you just have a surficial term at the end, as you often do with gravity. So the point being that this kinetic part here, it can be expressed as a quadratic form in the unconstrained phi functions, plus some field stuff. And remember that those phi functions were linear in the momentum and they had some field stuff on the end. So the signs of these kinetic, these quadratic terms here are going to tell you whether or not the theory is ghostly. And those signs are quite obviously affected by the signs of the dimensionless couplings that are in the theory. So you can see how quite clearly how you'd end up with ghost conditions forming here. So we do this analysis for all of the theories and we say, okay, well, what's the results? So remember that we had, you know, our map of theories which look good on the Minkowski background, and we found some pair of theories here which had some good background cosmology as well, perhaps really good. And of the eight cases which I've got here, actually only six of them appear on this map. So this map isn't actually complete. There are some theories which are just so ridiculous that I didn't even write them on there. But six of those eight do correspond to numbers on this map, and they all get ruled out. So this is ongoing work. We really want to sort of push the northwest and see if we can tell whether or not these theories are actually going to be viable or not. I would mention also that the way we're doing this now is with the computer algebra. So I've written a piece of code, which is really quite good at performing this Hamiltonian analysis. It shouldn't be too hard to generalize it beyond portion to things like the normicity or a Weyl connection gravity or something like that. But we can evaluate the Poisson matrices extremely quickly. The linearized constraint chains can also be done. When it comes to non-linearized constraints, you normally require a bit of imagination to actually figure out what's going on. It's hard to do algorithmically, but with a bit of human assistance, that can be done as well. So that's written in the Wolfram language, and trying to get that released at the moment. that's pretty much it. Just quickly summarize for you. I think that probably coincides with the time. We began with this catalog of theories which were allegedly quite healthy once you linearize them on Minkowski space without matter, without cosmological constant. Power counting, if you insist on that, then you find that you're not allowed to have an Einstein-Hilbert term in your theory. You also find that some strongly suggested theories that they are blind to the spatial curvature when you look at the cosmology. And yet even despite all of this, we get the flat Freeman solutions out. And on top of that, we have the option to change the early expansion history just as a boundary condition. So you would probably want that to follow on for some inflationary process at reheating. I haven't really looked into matching that yet. And you can also have a contribution to dark energy as well, if you want. So this is what I was going to mention about the Schwarzschild and the PP waves. They are possible. Read from that what you may. And more generally, torsion has an interesting and very rich phenomenology to it, which you can write as a scalar tensor theory to describe the cosmological background. It's got this very interesting non-canonical structure to it. But at the end of the day, the Hamiltonian analysis really has the final word, and that's still ongoing. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. I think I'm probably done. I don't know if. Thank you all for listening, and I definitely welcome your questions. I think there are probably quite a few that I brushed over earlier. So.
Okay, well, that's perfect. Actually, timing. All right.
Great. All right.
Thanks, Will. Here, I'll give Will a round of applause. Okay, great. Any further questions for Will? We've had a bunch already.
Professor F. Shorty has one. I can actually see hands coming up.
Oh, you're right.
I was clapping, but I can ask.
Oh, okay. I saw a hand appearing on your camera, so I thought.
Yeah. So what about perturbations? Do you ever worry about that?
To be honest, I worry more about stability. I'm beginning to think that this whole corpus of work has been done from the wrong direction, starting with the Minkowski and the linearized theory. I feel, it was a bullet point earlier, but I don't think I actually said it. I feel that a better way to do this would be to start with a nonlinear Hamiltonian analysis and think, you know, what is likely not to be susceptible from strong coupling. And then once you've done that and you've got a very formally written theory, then you look at exact solutions in the phenomenology of those. To answer your question, which I've just avoided, perturbations are probably going to be very complicated. The background cosmology, as I said, it only fields these two scalars, and I think it's quite likely that the vector and the tensor modes are going to be activated at some level here. There is one thing which might offer a ray of hope, which is that, as I said, the particular theories I was talking about, they are okay with the Schwarzschild metric. So I wouldn't be surprised, to some extent, the scalar part of perturbation theory, you can write it in terms of overdensities and so forth. So I wouldn't be surprised if it worked out okay, but I wouldn't claim that it would. I don't know what would happen with the tensor mode.
So I'm a bit confused that why. So you're saying that these when people originally worked this out, they just looked at perturbations around Minkowski, and that was okay.
Oh, my colleagues.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning. Yeah. So I'll actually linger on that slide because a lot of this is credit to them because this was a massive amount of work that went into this, and it was also done for computer algebra. So the way this was done is quite interesting. Basically, whether or not you're okay, whether or not you want a Minkowski vacuum, they said, okay, flat space, linearize it, take away the matter, take away the cosmological constant. Then your Lagrangian, you split this up into, I was just going to tell you how this is done. I don't know if that's going to answer your question, but you split up your Lagrangian into spin projection operators. And so you just end up with your field, operator field, and then you want to invert that Lagrangian operator. But generically, it's impossible because of these emergence gauge symmetries. And so you need to do a little bit of work to reduce the rank of that matrix, make that invertible. And in doing that, you change your field definitions. And so the structure of the propagator is going to be different in each case. So you then look at each case and say, well, are the powers of K in that propagator conducive to...
So I guess you're describing what you're doing. What I'm I'm trying to understand what you think is going to go wrong. Because, I mean, so... Do they claim that these theories that they identify are stable around Minkowski or not?
They do. Mm-hmm. Now, that stability refers to the linearized theory. So this is going to be, as I said, field operator field. the problems that normally arise with the high spin theories, and this is true, you know, of massive gravity as well, like the RGB theory, is you get this strong coupling problem where the quadratic part is fine, but the cubic part contains a ghost. And they've only considered, you know, without taking away from what they've done, they've only considered the quadratic part. And then, you know, it's what I would have done, right? It seems to be the most obvious thing to consider.
But so what does it mean for the cubic part to contain a ghost? Because, I mean, if you have a small perturbations, then, I mean, the quadratic part is what dominates. So if you have positive energy for a small perturbations, then that's what you care about.
Yes, I think the problem would emerge if you actually had some, you know, some features in your space time. I mean, obviously we don't live in Minkowski space. I think I would imagine, I'm not sure about this, but I would imagine that the problem would emerge, you know, if you encountered a region of strong gravity, as you would in nature, this would trigger the ghost mode to become activated. So this would be a problem.
That's not necessarily a problem because I mean our tests of gravity in the strong gravity regions are much more limited. So I mean, maybe it's a feature or a prediction, whatever. I mean, if it is a predictive theory in those regions, so that's, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily, I mean, it's obviously a problem because I mean, most of the places where we test gravity very precisely, we are very close to Minkowski. And the ghost is really a UV problem because what you're talking about is, I mean, do high energy particles have positive energy or not? So I think it's still a Minkowski problem for a small perturbation. So I don't really see a strong coupling could be a problem, but I mean, that just means that you have to do more calculations to understand what's happening. That doesn't mean that it's wrong.
I mean, the roots out of strong coupling that I've seen, I mean, you get these really weird things like a bumpy FRW, where they introduce some stochastic feature to the FRW background just to keep it stable. I would take that to be undesirable. I'd rather not deal with trying too hard to make it work. It just doesn't seem natural, but I take your point about Minkowski.
You've been mentioning some emergent gauge symmetries. You are saying for some specific choices of parameters.
Yes.
So what are them? They are on top of Poincaré.
Yes, on top of. I mean, you can never take away from Poincaré. That's baked in. So as to actually what they are, I don't know.
What they are.
You know, it will be possible to derive a formal statement of you know, the gauge generators, and that's what the Castellani algorithm does. But as for interpreting them, I don't know. I mean, the obvious one is there would be a conformal symmetry that emerges, and sometimes that does happen. So I go to
If you could promote non-linearly, then you would be safe. Well, most likely. If you cannot, then most likely, I mean, this.
So you mean the symmetry would not survive in the non-linear theory?
Yeah, that's the usual problem. Absolutely. That if you have an extra gauge symmetry at the linear level, which cannot be promoted to non-linear, then it's a trouble for the theory. Get additional degrees of freedom that get strongly coupled.
So it's related to strong coupling.
Very often to ghosts.
Right. Hmm. Okay. That's good. I didn't understand that. I mean, I expected that whatever symmetries we would get, it's not very likely that these are going to survive. When we go to the nonlinear level, it would require quite a conspiracy to preserve them. But it's interesting that you say that there could be negative consequences of that. I mean, this is obviously something that comes.
So just to understand the status of the linear theory. So you said it was analyzed without matter. But now if I add matter, do I recover Newton law at linear level? I mean, normal gravity at linear level?
You do. For this theory and also the one up here, you will, just because you have Schwarzschild, but...
It's not exactly the same because Schwarzschild is the solution of like vacuum equations.
Yeah, and you won't get the horizon right.
Not exactly the same as saying that I want to introduce a source like I would do for matter.
But you will get it if you look at something I did very briefly. But if you look at the Green's functions for the tensor mode, this has the form that you would expect. There's nothing weird like Yukawa. Or anything coming out of that. I'm pretty sure that it's the same.
I mean, is that to follow up on that? That was my question. I mean, you know, how much freedom do you have in choosing your coupling to matter? I mean, there must be a reason if there are more degrees of freedom in your theory in the beginning. How does that spoil any of this, the statements you're making about stability and so on and so forth?
So, sorry, what do you mean when you say freedom in choosing the coupling to matter?
How do the degrees of freedom in your theory with torsion couple to the matter? I mean, is it minimal through square root g? Square root
right.
Or something else, or what's the freedom?
So in the cases I've considered, if you're looking at coupling to matter for Minkowski, it's for a cosmology. You can do it all through mini superspace formalism, and then you just require that the matter contains some power of the scale factor. So this is going to be minimal coupling. That there are many other options that you can pick, and this is quite a big problem with the teleparallel theory that sometimes needs some quite weird couplings just to make things work. The other problem with the matter coupling is that this wasn't considered, with respect to the power counting argument.
But I mean, going back to Sergei's question, you answered that there's no Yukawa type force. I mean, that's contingent on some assumption you made about how matter appears, say in the equation we're saying, or based on the behavior of the Green's function, but clearly assumption on what's on the right side of that equation.
So this was, this is really just a straightforward stress energy tensor. You're going to get, I didn't really give much thought to how it would appear in the Lagrangian, but I was using the same formalism as you would for Einstein-Cartan gravity, where you get one Riemann-Cartan curvature and stress energy equation, and one for the torsion and the spin. I'd have to probably revisit it, but it would be the same as whatever minimal coupling is usually taken to be in Einstein-Cartan theory, which may or may not be a good thing. And I know that among the many controversies that the torsion can excite, people are very interested in could we detect this. I've seen work which has suggested that torsion would only be detectable if it had some weird non-minimal coupling to matter. The coupling problem is a whole other can of worms. It could be that minimal coupling is just not appropriate.
Thanks.
I think one relevant issue is that I think in the Einstein-Cartan theory, where you just take the Einstein-Hilbert action and generalize it to torsion, that there the torsion ends up just satisfying a constraint equation, so it's not a dynamical degree of freedom. Whereas I think in the more general quadratic terms, you'll be talking about the matter will actually source torsion waves, propagating waves.
So all you need for that to happen is a R squared term. Mm-hmm. Once you've got that, your torsion will propagate. I'm not a fan, and I didn't really say this, I'm not a fan of, in Einstein-Cartan, you get this algebraic spin-torsion relation. It just seems, we don't really see this sort of thing much in nature, so I've never felt comfortable with that. So I was quite pleased when this utilitarian scalar tensor theory told me that Einstein-Cartan theory was just a Cusketon. I'm a bit biased against that algebraic relation. I'll prefer to have
torsion.
So in the interest of time, maybe we should stop here because it's like 15 after almost. So Will has agreed to stay on the line, for a bit longer to chat with people here if they're interested. But first, let's just thank him again for a great talk.